It is pretty fun and exciting to get to speak with my wife today. Yeah. Normally you'd find her here at Good Life Mondays, Wednesdays, and Thursdays on the front counter doing little dances when people sign up to be gym members. It's pretty great. So come on down and sign up. Get in the gym. It's great to be here this morning. This morning we're talking about perspective. And so if you want to turn in your Bibles to 1 Samuel chapter 17, we're going to be looking at an Old Testament story many of us know about David and Goliath. It's a matter of perspective. Henry David Thoreau, an American essayist and naturalist, once said, "It's not what you look at that matters, it's what you see." It's not what you look at that matters, it's what you see. On Friday, a friend of mine pulled out his phone and showed me this picture and asked me what I saw. And let's see, we're going to put it up and you guys can tell me what you see. Do you see a young lady or an old lady? Or do you see an elephant riding a bicycle? Who sees the young lady? Who sees the old lady? More people see the old lady. Who sees both? You guys win. You guys can go home now. You're done. You're at the head of the class. Yeah, it's interesting, right? When we can look at the same picture and see different things. It's not what you look at that matters, it's what you see. Do you guys remember a couple years ago, there was that thing going around online about the dress, the gold dress or the gold and white or blue and black? Hey, did anybody remember that? I still don't understand how I can look at a black and a blue dress and see white and gold. It's interesting, right? It's a matter of perspective. There's all kinds of things that go into it. And so that's what we want to talk about this morning, is that perspective matters. It's easy to remain convinced of our own certainty or our own perspective if we remain where we are and never move. C.S. Lewis writes in the Chronicles of Narnia, in the book The Magician's Nephew, he says, "What you see and what you hear depends a great deal on where you are standing. It also depends on what sort of person you are." And my hope, and I think our hope and prayer this morning, is that we would be continually moving in the direction of Jesus, becoming more like him, seeing people and circumstances through the lens of his love and transformative power. And so today we're looking at this story of David and Goliath and the perspectives that we find in it. And are they good? Are they difficult? Are they bad? Do they need to be shifted? And then asking ourselves the question, what does it look like for us today to maybe shift our perspective so that it's more like David's, trusting in God, having an assurance in a good and a gracious God, that no matter the circumstances, that he is with us. And so when we jump into this story, we see two armies that have readied themselves for battle. One on one side of a valley and the other on the other side of a valley. And in this scenario steps out a 9-foot giant named Goliath, challenging the armies of Israel. And when we see him, I don't know about you, but I get this sense of arrogance and pride in Goliath. They're facing off, and in verse 10, this is what it says. "Then the Philistine, Goliath, said, 'This day I defy the armies of Israel. Give me a man and let us fight each other.'" Right? And I just get this feeling reading about all the things Goliath is carrying and his strength and his stature that he's not planning on losing. For him, this is a mere formality that he's going to take whoever Israel sends and break them in half, and they're going to win. And that arrogance just comes to the top. It comes to the surface. And right, I'm reminded, right, of this verse in Proverbs written by Solomon, the son of David, who said, "Pride goes before a fall and an arrogant spirit before destruction." I wonder, in hindsight, if this became one of those stories that David told his kids, that when you trust in God, what looks obvious on the outside is maybe not as obvious as you think it is.
The next person we see is David. And we see him talking to the men around him. And he says, "What will be done for the man who kills this Philistine and removes this disgrace from Israel? Who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God?" When Ryan and I talked about this, he said that he saw David as incredulous, gobsmacked, absolutely stunned that nobody had done anything about Goliath yet. But I definitely get anger simmering under that incredulity. Who is this uncircumcised Philistine? I don't know about you, but that doesn't sound like the kind of language you'd use around the dinner table. In my mind, these are the words you use when you see something so wrong that it makes you angry. Not just angry that it's wrong, but angry that nobody has done anything about it yet. When I hear these words, I see a chest puffed out, shoulders back. Who does this uncircumcised Philistine think he is? He is ready for a fight. And it's always interesting to me that when we assign motives to Bible characters based on their words, we often do it so differently. But if there's something I've learned in the last couple years, it's that we all relate to God differently. And that's because of the way we're wired. But that's never a surprise to God, because he's the one who created us so diverse. So it does make me wonder that when you read this verse, would you have assigned a different perspective to David because of those words? But for now, we're going with anger and incredulity for David.
So David asks this question. Who is this guy? What will be done for the person that fights him? And that's an interesting question, right? Like, in my mind, again, David has this assurance that the only outcome for Israel is a winning outcome. What will be done for the person that fights this guy? And so some soldiers kind of relay this information, you know, this all of this good stuff. No taxes, you get to marry the king's daughter, you know, blah, blah, blah. But then in comes this next person, David's older brother. Right? And this perspective is a really interesting perspective for us to just stop and consider for a moment. Because when I look at this, I see Eliab's perspective is something completely different from David's. Let's check out verse 28. I'm reading from the NIV. It says, "When Eliab, David's oldest brother, heard him speaking with the men, he burned with anger at him and asked, 'Why have you come down here? Who have you left those few sheep with in the desert? I know how conceited you are and how wicked your heart is. You only came to watch the battle.'" Classic brother conversation, am I right? Like, I hear this play out in my own home all the time. Older brother, younger brother, lots of fighting and then tears. Right? And Eliab, if you didn't know anything else, you'd be like, wow, why is this guy so angry? Like, what's the deal? He doesn't believe the best. He doesn't ask David what he's doing there. He immediately assigns blame and is anger and full of anger. And I think it's important for us to just note who he is and what's happened to him. Because just a chapter before, and we don't know necessarily the how much time has passed, but the prophet of God had gone to Jesse's home. God had called him there to anoint a new king. And Eliab, being the oldest, is the first one to be presented to Samuel. Tallest, strongest, most experienced. We don't know. He's the oldest, but he's passed over. God says, "You're not the one." And so Samuel says, "No, this guy's not it." And in fact, it goes through the whole family, right? If you know the story, he goes through all the sons until there's not one left, and Samuel's a bit disappointed. Says to Jesse, "Is this really all you've got? I guess there's one more, but you don't really want to see him, do you?" He didn't even get invited to the party. And I can imagine the resentment or the bitterness again, right, that's probably rising up in the older brothers. But God says something different about David, right, in this chapter. And as Samuel is having this back and forth with God, he says, is this really the one? He's young, he's inexperienced, he's this and he's that. And God says to Samuel, man looks on the outward appearance, but God looks on the heart. And it's interesting that we see this very thing kind of pointed out by Eliab. I know how conceited you are. You've just come to watch the battle. Eliab's perspective is full of anger and resentment and bitterness, maybe even a little jealousy.
And then we see Saul. And I want to take you back again as well, two chapters this time, where Samuel told Saul, because you have rejected the word of the Lord, he has rejected you as king. Saul was not following God, and he had been rejected. And now he's just spent 40 days, every day, listening to Goliath taunt him and his army. He was afraid. And I would even go so far as to say that in his mind, he was already defeated. And I have an opinion here that I have formed by reading the story. It is not explicitly stated in the story, but it is the way I feel when I read it. It could be wrong. But I think that Saul never expected David to win. He gave him the battle, but he fully intended to lose. And I think he was just waiting for somebody who would volunteer to die and start the whole series of events, because he was tired of the waiting and he was afraid. It makes no sense that David would win if you look at it from a battle strategy point. But I think the other reason that I think that is because it's something we all do sometimes. We wait for someone else to stand up and volunteer so that whatever it is we're faced with, when it fails, it's not our fault.
And so David is getting ready to go and fight Goliath. He said, I'll go. I'll do it. And so he heads out to fight Goliath. And now we come to Goliath's perspective again, one of arrogance, right? One of anger and defiance. But in this situation, he sees who's coming towards him to fight him, and he is insulted. Right now the script is flipped. He's the one who's incredulous. He's the one who's still mouthy and arrogant, but he is insulted. Like everyone else, Goliath doesn't expect to lose. He doesn't think David has a chance at winning. But for us, what we understand in hindsight is it's actually Goliath who never had a chance. In verses 43 and 44, Goliath spits out these last words. He despised David. Am I a dog that you would come at me with sticks? And he cursed David by his gods. He says, come here, and I will give your flesh to the birds of the air and the beasts of the field. He could not believe who they sent out to fight him.
So then we come back to David again, and he stands in front of Goliath now, full of confidence and trust. And that is his perspective, trust in God. He says to Goliath, this day the Lord will deliver you into my hands, and I'll strike you down, and I'll cut off your head. This very day I will give the carcasses of the Philistine army to the birds and the wild animals, and the whole world will know that there is a God in Israel. Boom! That guy throws down, and then he backs it up. We know how the story goes after that, don't we? Goliath moves forward to attack David, and David does not hesitate. He runs to the battle lines. He hurls a stone from his sling, hits Goliath in the forehead. Goliath falls face down, and David goes and takes Goliath's own sword from him and chops off his head. Game over.
Game over. Mic drop. That's right. I think we've got a picture in our mind, right, of how just incredible this story actually is. This is the kind of things that we go and watch at the movies, right? This is the ultimate underdog winning. Right? This is kind of what we cheer for, but the truth is from God's perspective, this was never in doubt. And God's looking for people who trust him. And for us, I wonder what it's like in our own lives as we read this story, as we consider the perspectives that we encounter, perspectives of arrogance, perspectives of anger and jealousy, perspectives of defeatedness, just being defeated, perceptions of rejection, right? These different things that I think are all common to humanity, these different ways of viewing life. It's not important what you look at. What's important is what you see. And for us, I think it becomes this opportunity for us to ask the question, does my perspective need to change? It matters where we stand and what sort of people we are. What's your perspective? What's your thoughts on God? What's your thoughts on your own relationship with him? Or what about the things that even seem like a giant in your own life? Would it be beneficial for you to have a change of perspective? Changing your perspective is challenging and can be painful, but I think that it's extremely worthwhile. It's easy to get used to seeing things the same way when we never move or grow or continue to work out our salvation with fear and an awe of a good and a gracious God. For me, change of perspective comes, I have a little simple formula, right, that I use. And it's not a formula in that it creates a better outcome for me. It's a formula that I use to really evaluate how I'm thinking and how I'm believing. And for me, it comes through one of three things, or maybe a combination of these three things. It's a change of pace, or a change of place, or a change of priorities. And recently, I went with the youth group on this Getting Away with God trip to Fraser Island. It was an awesome opportunity to spend extended alone time with God. Solitude. I love me some alone time. So I'm like, I'm there. I love it. What I found, though, is that I don't really like alone time. I love to read. I love to listen to podcasts. I love to listen to music. I love to catch up on all of the world news, the things that are happening. It's just a shameful thing. I love Twitter. It's terrible. I periodically delete it off of my phone because I love it that much, and then I put it back on my phone, right? Because it's got all the news and all the latest Star Wars information, right? And I do. I love solitude, but I had this change of pace. I had this change of place, and I had no phone reception. I had downloaded three just books I was keen to read, and then I forgot my Kindle at home. So I didn't have my phone, didn't have my Kindle. I had my Bible. I had a journal. And I thought I had downloaded a playlist of like 50 instrumental songs. There were 4 songs on the playlist. It was just me. It was just me and Jesus. And that was terrifying. Can I just be honest? Even for a pastor. What I found was that solitude was a defense mechanism. That really, it's not my path to God. For some people it is. It's not a path to a deeper relationship with him. But really for me, what I found was that my change of perspective, my pathway to deepening my relationship with God came from being still and listening, not filling my mind with more information, which is my default. And I was reminded there in Fraser, surrounded by the beauty of God, the birds, the bugs, the water, the trees, of Psalm 46, where it says, be still and know that I am God. There's another version that says, cease striving and know that I am God. And I also really appreciate how Eugene Peterson paraphrases it in the Message. He says, step out of the traffic, right? Step out of the traffic. Change your pace. Change your place. And take a long, loving look at me. Change your priorities. Yeah. It was painful, but it was really beneficial for me in understanding that if I want to be someone who trusts God, that my priorities were more selfish than they were, than I thought they were. And it was challenging, but it was really beneficial as I move into the new year on seeing what it looks like to trust God more.
I never wondered if solitude was my pathway to God and if I should go on a solitary retreat. Never. One of my ways to change my perspective is through remembering. And I don't just mean remembering in a generic sense where you just remember everything that's ever happened. Plenty of guys on that battlefield were doing that, and it did not help them at all, like Saul. But what I mean is that sometimes when we're in a dangerous or a scary situation, we forget to remember the good things that God has done for us in the past. But David, in the middle of this story, he remembered, and he told Saul. He reminded him of times where he was shepherding and a lion or a bear would come and try to take his sheep. And he says, I ran after him and I killed the bear and I killed the lion and I rescued the sheep. He says to him, your servant has killed both the lion and the bear. This uncircumcised Philistine will be like one of them because he has defied the armies of the living God. The Lord who rescued me from the paw of the lion and the paw of the bear will rescue me from the hand of this Philistine. And I remember a time when I said similar words, except without the killing of the bear and the lion and the Philistine. But I remember when I recounted God's faithfulness to me. It was when we were planning to move to Australia. My boys were 1, 4, and 8 at the time. And I know that many of you have probably heard this story before, but the thing is, it's never going to lose its power for me. And so I'm never going to stop telling it to you, and I'm never going to stop telling it to myself. So we're planning to move to Australia, and I was afraid of the snakes and the spiders. I was certain that one or all of us were going to die of wild animal. Certain. And it's ridiculous now, right? I've lived here 7 years, and I see how ridiculous it is. But in that moment, it was not. It was real, and it was terrifying. So this one day, we're in the kitchen, and a little hobo spider runs across the kitchen. And my little barefoot one-year-old Charlie runs across and stomps on it. And we were so afraid. We were like, oh, no, he's so little. He could have been bitten, and he was barefoot, and it was venomous, and on and on and on and on. And then it stopped me. And I said to myself, it's not like we're going from somewhere safe to somewhere dangerous. Washington State had its own set of, you know, dangers, including some that were very similar, black widow spiders and rattlesnakes. But we had made it through. We had lived there so long. And that same faithful God who had kept us safe in Washington was the same God that was going with us to Australia. I knew then that when I remembered what he had done for us in the past, it would renew my faith that he would continue to do it in the future. When I'm afraid, I speak out loud of God's past faithfulness to me. Sometimes I say it to someone else, but sometimes I only say it to myself. As we check our perspective and we change our perspective, we also need to keep our perspective right once we've got it there. And one way I think we can do that is by always looking for opportunities to help, to do good. Maybe a better way to say what I mean is, see the problems in front of you as opportunities to help. Don't wait for someone else to volunteer so that you don't have to. If you can do something to help, then do it. In this story, David knew that he could help. He knew that he could affect change in that situation where everyone else felt like they couldn't. And so he did. Like Galatians says in 6:10, therefore, whenever we have the opportunity, we should do good to everyone, especially those in the family of faith. What's in front of you today that feels giant? Do you need to take some time to step out of the traffic? Do you, like Ryan said, need to slow down, step away for a minute, and take stock of your priorities in that situation? What faithfulness of God in your life are you forgetting about? Remember it. Tell it to someone. I challenge you today to tell a story of God's faithfulness in your life to someone else, maybe over a meal after you leave church today. And then remind yourself of it next time you're afraid. And finally, what opportunities are you missing? What's the thing that's in front of you that you can help? Maybe it's that thing that feels giant right now. Maybe it's something small that other people would overlook. If you can help, then do it. I want to pray for us this morning as we go. God, thank you that you are always with us. God, whether we are afraid or whether we are filled with confidence, it doesn't change the fact that you walk beside us. God, help us to hear your voice this morning, to take to heart the things that we've heard, the things that have spoken straight to us. God, not to walk out and forget. God, build our confidence and build our faith. Help us to change our perspectives. In your name I pray.